A reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 32, Entanglement and Fruitive Activities, Text Number 9. After experiencing the inhabitable time of the three modes of material nature, known as two parardas, Lord Brahma closes the material universe, which is covered by layers of earth, water, air, fire, ether, mind, ego, and so on, and goes back to Godhead. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The word avyakritam is very significant in this verse. The same meaning is stated in Bhagavad Gita in the word sanatana. This material world is vyakrita, or subject to changes, and it finally dissolves. But after the dissolution of this material world, the manifestation of the spiritual world, the Sanatana Dham, remains. That spiritual sky is called avyakrita, that which does not change. And there the Supreme Personality of Godhead resides. When, after ruling over the material universe under the influence of the time element, Lord Brahma desires to dissolve it and enter into the kingdom of God, others then enter with him. So here he's talking, Kapila Dev is tracing out the history of those people who are the worshippers of the Hiranyagarbha, the super soul. They don't immediately go back to Godhead, but stay into the time of the dissolution of the universe. So here, this is Brahma at the end of his lifetime, which lasts for the period of time of 1,000 yuga cycles. Very long. No, one day is a yuga cycle. One day of Brahma is 1,000 yuga cycles. Well, really 994 real yuga cycles. The others are sanjas between the manus. So that's one day, excuse me, and then of course the a year, and then 100 years. So it's a very, very long time. Somewhere in Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada calculates it's out trillions of years. A very long time. This is the impermanent place. Those who are who understand this understand also that this is not our home. We don't belong here. The point is made in Bhagavad Gita in the eighth chapter. I remember in a morning walk in Mayapur, Prabhupada was repeating all the time about this material world, bhutva, bhutva, praliyate, bhutva, bhutva, praliyate. Again and again they are born, again and again destroyed. And then, but the devotees that were with him didn't know what he was referring to. They came and asked me, and I was able to find it in the Bhagavad Gita. Here it's in the eighth chapter, where Krishna says, in text 16, from the highest planet in the material world down to the lowest, all are places of misery wherein repeated birth and death take place. But one who attains my abode, O son of Kunti, never takes birth again. So from Abrahma, from Brahma, Bhuvanat, up to the Brahmaloka planet, all of them. So even Brahma finally has to abandon, even though he's there for such a long time, he has to abandon the situation. So then he says, by human calculation, 1,000 ages, meaning 1,000 yuga cycles, taken together for the form the duration of Brahma's one day and also the duration of his night. At the beginning of Brahma's day, all living entities become manifest from the unmanifest state. And thereafter, when the night falls, they are merged into the unmanifest again. Again and again, Brahma's day arrives. When Brahma's day arrives, all living entities come into being, and with the arrival of Brahma's night, they are helplessly annihilated. This was Bhutagrama Saivayam Bhutva Bhutva Praliyate. Bhutva Vupa means taking birth, and Praliyate means annihilated. So there are, and then he says, yet there's another unmanifest nature, which is eternal and transcendental. This is the sanatana that Prabhupada referred to here, sanatana. To this manifest and unmanifest nature, it is supreme and is never annihilated. When all this world is annihilated, that part remains as it is. That which the Vedantas describe as unmanifest and infallible, avyakta and akshara, or here, avyakrita, that which is known as the supreme destination, that place from which, having attained it, one never returns, that is my supreme abode. So here's where Krishna presents this. So this Bhutva Praliyate means devastations over and over and over again. This verse also mentions that this is this is the changing place, the vyakrita, not the avyakrita. And so here there's the time factor. And Prabhupada describes time as destruction. When Krishna shows his kala rupa, it's destruction. So we are in the place of destruction, of and they're just devastations within devastations within devastations within devastations. It's always happening. Again and again born, again and again destroyed, again and again born. That's like everybody. The whole world is devastated at these periodical intervals. Even their devastations at the end of a yuga cycle, then a recreation. And we go in this material world, we're devastated. We have our own personal pralaya called death, and then again born, and then die, born and then die. What's the point? I read an article somewhere about some of these little, in the summer, these little tiny insects that come up. And the insects hatch out of the eggs of the larva. And they live for such a brief period of time, they have no mouth. Because all they do is, they there's no need to eat. They live on what, and fuel is in there. But the adult stage, there's no mouth, and they live such a brief time, they just mate and lay eggs and die. Anyway, so I was describing this to one lady, a devotee, and she said, "What's the point?" Well, what is the point? basically buddha, buddha, pliyate, on all levels, what is the point to keep coming through this? So we are to understand from these descriptions that there's always devastations going on, and the material world is a place of devastation, periodic devastations. You know, right now there seems to be climate change going on, and maybe this is due to human activity, but also they happen on a periodic level. Sometimes it gets warmer and sometimes it gets colder. Sometimes you have a devastation by heat, and sometimes you have a devastation by cold. The ice retreats and the ice expands, and the ice retreats and the ice expands. And so we can see, you know, what they're talking about. If this warming continues, the sea level will rise, and island nations in the Pacific will disappear, and the Netherlands is going to have a really hard time. And so, yeah, really, anyway, you know, it doesn't take that much of a rise in sea level. Florida will disappear. It'll be a little chain of islands. And when these devastation happens, it's horrible. And we have devastations by hurricanes. In America, we especially have these lovely thing called tornadoes. And there's a part of the country called Tornado Alley. I used to live there for a period of time. And every so often in the town, you know, the fire whistles, fire sirens would blow, and everybody would know it was time to take shelter. And you're supposed to have, every house is supposed to have at least something underground where you can go. And recently there was a big tornado in one of these states, Kansas, or where they're always happening. And it was going around like that. And it was a mile wide. And it went through this town. And there was practically nothing left standing. It was just, people came out of their cellars and looked up, and there was just nothing there. The whole town had just disappeared. And then, you know, New Orleans with the hurricanes, or what they call cyclones, and they have different names, hurricanes in America, or the cyclones in India, typhoons up in the Pacific region, you know, these gigantic, also circular storms like that. So these come, and then what are the other devastations? Tsunamis, that's a big one too. This everything is, you think is permanent and everything is nice, and it's just wiped out. And these are very minor occasions. And when people undergo these devastations, you know, they all suffer, they say, from post-traumatic stress disorder, and they have to have therapy and so on. First of all, if anyone's a little alert as just the nature of the material world, they should see it's devastation all the time. I really, that's what the Kala Rupa shows us in the Bhagavad Gita. When Krishna shows this form to Arjuna, time I am, the destroyer of the world, I have come to engage all people. This is a famous quotation. When the first atomic bomb was exploded in Los Alamos, Mexico, It was scary for one thing is there was some speculation that if you set off this atomic bomb, it might set a chain reaction and the whole atmosphere of the world might blow up with it. So there was this possibility. They went ahead anyway. But one of the famous scientists that was there was Robert Oppenheimer. And when he saw this go up, he quoted the Bhagavad Gita. He was reading Bhagavad Gita and Vedanta and stuff like that. He especially liked the Bhagavad Gita. He quoted that verse, although he said, "I am death, the destroyer of the worlds, and I've come to engage all people." This atomic fireball, this mushroom cloud, reminded him of this universal form. So if you just know the force of time, it's always happening. In the Christian religion, they have this thing they call the apocalypse, which describes from there the end of the world, where there's plagues and war and famine and so on. But this is supposed to happen at the end. And if you look at the Bible, there's a kind of a vision of this apocalypse that's there. Somebody almost sees it. And that reminds me very much also of the universal form. I think that somebody somehow got a glimpse of that feature, maybe of the Lord's universal form, but somehow they're thinking it's at the end. But if you understand that this is the universal form, and that apocalypse is followed by Judgment Day. But what we learned, the real fact is from the Bhagavad Gita is that it's apocalypse now, as the movie, famous movie. Every day is Judgment Day. It's not at the end, it's right now. And every day it's apocalypse. Time is passing and time is destruction. So we're actually living through devastations. We just don't notice. We just make ourselves oblivious. Soldiers who have been in combat for a period of time in some ways never recover, because it seems to them that from the accounts I read, it seems to them that when there's actual warfare and everybody's dying around them and you can die any minute yourself, and they survive it, it seems to them that now they're seeing the real face of the world. And when peace comes, they don't trust it. They think that at any minute the veil can be ripped off and again material nature will show her real feature. And therefore, sometimes they're very nervous people. They can't relax and be at ease, because at any time this can happen. The thing is, they're right. I mean, war is just sort of ordinary life speeded up a little bit, just a little more revealed, because here we're in a nice, peaceful place and everything is, there's no war. But yet, all around us, people are dying. There's a mortality rate going on all the time. And we don't pay any attention to it. We ignore this fact. And we have to ignore this fact in order to be sane. In other words, in order to be sane, we have to be insane. A devotee, however, can face reality. Because the reason that people have to ignore this is they're trying to be happy in this world. Because this is an impossible project, given the way the world is, they have to pretend, they have to put this covering of illusion over it, or the illusory energy does it for them, and they buy into it. They want this illusion, so they can. It's a nice day in Marchaloka. The sun is shining, and people are dying everywhere, and growing old and becoming diseased. Isn't it nice? Aren't we having a good time? The real fact, and this is why people are pretty much sleepwalking through their lives. You see, if you, I think we are just like these soldiers. They suffer from traumas, post-traumatic stress disorder. Every living entity in the material world, as far as I can see, is also suffering from a trauma. Some psychiatrists have speculated there's a birth trauma, you know, leaving the womb, which is supposed to be nice and peaceful and happy, and then you come out and it's cold place. Or, of course, many people are thinking there's childhood hidden trauma, of hidden child abuse and all this other stuff, and everybody's pretty much traumatized one way or the other. They don't go really far enough. There is a trauma, but the trauma is the trauma of falling into this place. We are eternal spirit souls, and we are originally in the spiritual atmosphere. But now we find ourselves in the material world. We have fallen. And suddenly we are sat, but everything around us is asat. And we have this profound sense of not belonging. I even remember, you know, at a certain age of sort of waking up, you know, 3 or 4 years old or something like that, and all of a sudden I had this sense of here I am, and I'm in this, you know, little boy's body, and here are these great big people, the giants. That are my father and my mother, and there's his brother, and there's, I'm just like you find yourself in the middle of an ongoing drama, but everybody has got a part to play, and people are trying to tell you, and this is your part. You have a boy's body, so that's already one part, you know, and you're in this family, so that's already one little thing. Across the street, you know, there's another family, and there's other kids in there. And I wonder, why am I here and not there? You know, how did I get here? It was like so weird to be in this way. And if you tried to express it, nobody had any idea of what you're talking about. So really, we're just thrown into this world. And then, of course, different things happen. At least I can remember we had some kitty cat in our family that got hit by the car. And that was like, of course, this nice, beautiful cat was suddenly this bloody mess on the street in front of the house. But I, you know, when I cut my finger, I see the same stuff come out of me. And so I put two and two together. And it was... I mean, horrifying. When I tried to talk about this to my parents, they didn't, they just kind of blew it off. Actually, I think the first thing I worried about was my parents dying. And then me, and they, oh no, not for a long time, and you know, what happens? Well, we go to heaven. Did the cat go to heaven? That's what I was worried about, my cat. Well, they weren't sure about the cat. And what is this heaven thing? And, you know, I mean, it was just like... And people don't want to talk about it. And so we lead normal lives, so-called normal lives, by shutting this out. We have a project to enjoy in the world. And in order to do that, we have to become stupid. We have to become unconscious. And the tendency of living entities, in order to make this place into our own little kingdom of God, when it's actually Marcha Loka, we have to deny reality. So the whole human race is really in denial. As a psychiatrist or psychologist say, we're not facing the facts, because the facts are so horrible that if we're attached to these bodies and attached to things in this world being nice, we will go crazy. We'll like these soldiers in a war, you know? I mean, they say that a soldier in combat has a maximum span of effective service of maybe a week and a half. And if they're not physical casualties or psychological casualties, I mean, unless you're a Kshatriya, maybe, but there aren't any, really. They're just, you know, shudras with guns. So how do we get to the world? We become unconscious. We ignore what's going on. But here's the thing: if you want to lower the threshold of consciousness, you also stop living. You cannot become selectively unconscious, and so your whole level of awareness, by not confronting the issues of your existence, why am I here, what am I doing here, what's going on, what's the purpose, why do we have to die, by not really confronting it, and simply blocking it out, We dim our own capacity to perceive and to feel all across the board. So this is why most people are not, they're the living dead. You know that, the Night of the Living Dead, these movies. They're the undead. They're living, but they're not living. And so what happens to people is they get hypnotized by, and really we have whole industries of unconsciousness, like television. It just hypnotizes us and distractions, all to keep us out of mind. We have intoxicants of various kinds. So that our happiness has to be chemically induced in some way. We have sports. The most exciting thing is a football game. Just wasting time. And what is our lives? Well, everybody, you're programmed to do this. You go to school. And they want to make you one of the undead. They want you to be a productive citizen, so they train you so that when you graduate, you then go to some kind of work. And you do the same very boring thing day after day after day. And then you come home in the evening, you watch television, you have a little sex, you go to sleep, you get up and do the same day after day, month after month, year after year. Every part of the year you go on a little vacation to some little place. You have 1 week where you watch television, have a little sex, drink some beer, maybe, you know, all day instead of just the evening, and then you go back. And then one day you wake up and you're old and your life is over and you think, what happened? You think something important was supposed to have happened. I missed it. What was it? And then they just sedate you and So you'll so your own, you don't even your own process of death you don't experience. So you die the same way you've lived, just completely befuddled and bewildered and drugged out in some way or another. This is not human life. And generations and generations and generations are going through this. And so they don't really live. So Krishna consciousness is to really make people come awake, you know, like Jeev Jaga, wake up. People, as long as we are in identifying the self with the material body, as long as we have this basic false ego, one of these elements here, you know, then it's too horrible. And most people, when they try to confront this, you know, another interesting thing about war is, although it's horrible, right, Sisi Gorni Tai, and it's traumatic, there are people who like it in spite of that, because they never feel so alive. This is a universal report by people because they were forced to confront it. They are forced to see death everywhere. And they were forced to say in some way, you know, I cast my fate to the winds, I just... and somehow or other they were just so intensely consciousness because of that danger. Whenever they put themselves in danger, and really confronted the faith, they felt very alive. So some people seek that again and again. People, therefore, they like extreme sports. They really put themselves into danger just so they can feel alive. We're in danger every minute, actually. And what makes you feel alive is not the danger itself, but just having gotten rid of that thick layer of unconsciousness about the nature of reality. And people, most of these people, they can only take it for brief periods of time. But Prabhupada has described Krishna consciousness as that, he says, you experience every moment with a thrill. Because we have an essence, by Krishna consciousness, we have already confronted and gone through the process of death. By giving up our claim on the material body and on things in the world, that's essentially dying. Prabhupada said that everyone meets Krishna in the form of death. They surrender to Krishna. Everyone has to surrender to Krishna. We preach to people to surrender to Krishna. But in one sense, they have to surrender anyway. It's constitutional. Everyone has to surrender to Krishna. But the way most people surrender to Krishna, that is at the time of death. And to them it's a horrible experience. They meet Krishna in the form of death because he says, Ritu Sarva Harascham, I am all-devouring death. So what this means is, Here is the materialist who's got his little God project going, has accumulated money or position or fame or something like that, thinking he's, you know, making his kingdom of God on earth and being the greatest. Ignoring reality. But the thing about reality is it has this You have to come to terms with it sooner or later. For so long you can cloud the truth, but eventually the truth is the truth. That's why it's better than fiction, because it's real. And so what happens is at the time of death, suddenly they have to give up all their acquirements. Death to them is whatever money they had, whatever fame they had, whatever enjoyment they had, it's taken away. And by what? Well, material nature. It's taken away by material nature. And they surrender to Krishna. They bow down. They fall flat on their faces and they submit, because that's the reality. We have to do this. When we're under the control of the material energy, that's how we do it. So essentially, it means that they give up everything and they bow down to Krishna. Now, what happens in devotional service? Well, the same thing. But we do it the nice way. We understand by analysis that actually it's a fiction that we have anything to give up. We don't own anything. We may say, this is my land, but the land, this piece of land that I have this imposed, this stamp, mine on it, it was here millions of years before me and millions of years after me. Where's the my? I'm just blowing it over it like smoke. But where's the my? It's all a fiction. And so I don't really possess anything. That's just the reality. It's just I made up this whole thing of this belongs to me. I may have different relationships with people, but the force of time is going to separate us. What is this relationship? It's all a fabrication. It's all made up in our heads. It's all imaginary. So we see this. We come to the temple, we give up everything, and we bow down before Krishna voluntarily, and we meet Krishna in a very wonderful way. But I've had the experience, you know, at a Sunday feast or something of Jai Om Vishnupad, and everybody's down on the floor except some guys in the back, and they got this look of horror. And all these people bowing down, you know. And I know that you could see what they say, I'll never do that, you know, I'll never bow down. But they will. They'll also offer their, you know, dandabats when the time comes. They have to do it. So a devotee voluntarily understands that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We're his servants. We engage in his service. In the course of that, we also can come to the spiritual realization that this body is a useful thing. It's going to go. And we strive to give up our attachment to it. It has some instrumental value, but when it goes, hey, chug it off. I can live without it. I can live without it. And then we can become really alive. We don't have our happiness invested in the course of material nature. That's the disastrous thing to do. It's such a bad investment. That to make my happiness depend upon what happens in the material world. How can anyone be so stupid? Well, because they think there's no place else to put it. That's the problem. But when there's the relationship with Krishna, our happiness does not depend upon the course of material nature. And we place our prospects for happiness and our future and Krishna consciousness, then it doesn't bother us what happens. And so then our consciousness can expand to without a limit. It's not, We're not confined by all these man-made fictions that we mistakenly call life. When we're covered by all that illusion, we don't even see the world as it is. We don't see reality. All because really we've blocked. You know, we've decided I want to be the supreme. Icha desha samutena dvanda mahena bharataha. We come into the world and we're covered by desire and hate. And you can see this is true. Even the basic little squiggle of life has desire and hate. Every little organism goes toward the things that satisfies its senses and avoids those things which will harm it or block its sense satisfaction. It's really push-pull mechanism of organism, any organism, desire and hate. But where does it come from? Prabhupada says the original desire is, why can't I be God? And the original hate is, why should Krishna be God? So there, when I'm going to become God, and there is no, and Krishna is not God, that's the illusion. That's the fabrication. That's the made-up story. And it never works. It never works. So once we come to this reality, we can actually start to really live our own lives. We don't have to become sleepwalking through history. And at the end say, what happened? What was all that about? Was it about anything? Because we have this human consciousness, we're dimly aware, at least, that I should be doing something important, but nobody has told me what it is. And instead I just, you know, worked for 30 years, got a gold watch, retired, and played cards, and then died. What's the point? For devotees, we should understand the nature of this material world. It's a fatal mistake to look for happiness in this material world, and of course, it is in fact the cause of all suffering. To look for happiness in the material world, it's not located here. It's just not. You have a few cheap thrills which we may mistake for happiness, but that's not what it is. Naturally, we want actual happiness. We're bliss seeking. It's part of the nature of the soul. So we actually know where to go and where to find it and what to do to approach it. We should do that and not be distracted by all the billboards, the commercials. The whole material world is like one big commercial. We all know they're lies, huh? They're just meant to sell a product. These are part of the agents of Maya, the ones that are man-made, but the others are just made by material nature. Come here, you'll be happy. Get this, you'll be happy. It's all false. So that's why it's good to study these things, bhutva praliyate, and to keep in mind the real nature of the material world. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna lists as items of knowledge of the evils of birth, death, old age, and disease. And Prabhupada remarks in the purport, these things should be discussed. And one should know this. He said, one should be pessimistic about this material world. Not that devotees are, that pessimism is realism. It's not a false idea, but not be pessimistic about life because one knows what to do and how to invest our energy in Krishna consciousness and not be distracted by all these other things. So we actually know what to do. with a little bit of care and attention, we can be situated in Krishna consciousness. When that happens, we begin to see, what about the living dead? What about the people that are not living their own lives? And we should feel for them. And try to wake them up. Any questions, comments? Yes?
You mentioned that when we take birth, we're reporting this, we're covered by desire and hatred.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if you could elaborate a little, because I tend to think of hate as something that would lead to like aggression or something like that. But in this sense, it sounds more like if there was something you hate and you just avoid it and you're seeking things that could bring pleasure.
Yeah, it of course can have an aggressive aspect, but it can also just be the protecting. Icha dvesha. Dvesha Prabhupada often translates as he uses the word envy a lot, but it's just the perception of something as inimical, as harmful or hostile to me.
Repulsion.
Huh?
Repulsion.
Yeah, sometimes. When I had this some course in university somewhere where I think it was in a biology or psychology or something, and the professor drew an oval on the blackboard, and he said, "This represents any organism." And then he drew a arrow to the right, and he said, "This is approach." That the organism goes toward those things that'll satisfy it and help keep it alive. And the arrow going in the opposite direction, he called this avoidance. So approach and avoidance. So aggression can be both. I mean, when a lion goes to eat, it's aggression, right? As approach, and avoidance is anything that can hurt the lion, he either avoids or also tries to destroy first. So aggression comes on sort of both of these things. So part of the avoidance is just fear. That's my understanding of what this icha and dvesha. It's all pervading, but originally it's related in this avoidance of Krishna. If I want to be God, then if somebody else is there, I can't do it. Even Nietzsche said it, right out. He said, how can there be gods? Because I couldn't stand it if I were not a god myself. Some people actually express this ambition. And you see, in the material world, basically, everyone has a kind of a God project going. I mean, sometimes it's a very little God project. Some people have big scope of action, and some people have smaller scope of action. But within their scope of action, they've got God projects. I worked in an office where there was one person pretty low on the hierarchy, the totem pole, was the secretary who happened to control the supply closet. So if you needed typewriter ribbon or paper or pencils, you had to go to her to get them. And it turned out that you had to offer your respectful obey. If you made her angry or didn't please her, you wouldn't get yours. So you had to go buy them out of your own money, because somehow or other she wasn't there. And she was the lord of the supply closet. She was the lord of all she surveyed. She just surveyed very little. And Prabhupada remarks that somebody wants to be the master. If all else fails, they get a dog. Now I'm the rollover, play dead, or whatever. Oh, I saw a cartoon in the newspaper where is some kind of firm or company or something, and one guy, obviously the boss, kicks another guy. Then you see the next frame, he's kicking somebody else down lower, and he kicks somebody else, and finally the last guy goes home and kicks his dog. So really, everyone has got this a kind of a God project, a kind of immortality project going on in the material world. So where's Krishna? Not relevant. In some ways, it's displaced. We want to have eternal life, and it's not available. So we have different ways of trying to be eternal. One is fame. You get to be famous, and then you, in some field of endeavor, you become the immortals. Remember, they call them the immortals. In America, we have the Baseball Hall of Fame. Somebody just by playing baseball, and you know, then he's got his gold statue. So people they want to be important, they want to be significant. These things are all in gold because gold is the immutable metal. It is a natural symbol of spiritual life. It doesn't rust, it doesn't decay. Gold is a material element, is the closest thing to this avyakrita or avyakta. You know, avyakrita doesn't change. So even collecting gold is a kind of an immortality project in a way. And then, of course, they like to have monuments or... Of course, nobody can afford gold anymore, so they have something that looks like gold. Sometimes you go into people's rooms and he bowling. Do you have that sport here where they bowl, right? The bowling trophies all lined up on the wall, you know. All these different games that people play, you know, try to lord it over, or be the greatest, or be important. But I mean, what happens? You know, people become Napoleon, to become, you know, go down in history as a great man and do all these things. But then, you know, 100 years later, you're just some troublesome name that schoolboys have to remember and forget. And nobody really cares anymore, you know? They're into Paris Hilton or something, you know, whatever the latest celebrity is. Anything else? Yeah?
I was wondering that sometimes we hear that you should only be attached to Krishna and, I don't know, Guru and Krishna. Like that, at least I heard that many years back, and so because Krishna may take anyone else away. But in the life of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then we see that he was always surrounded by this sannyasis and jagadana and like that. So how can you explain a little bit about?
Yeah, you should be also attached to devotees who are all those things that are in relationship to Krishna.
It is alright.
Yeah. This is sankirtan. Either we go back to Godhead altogether, or we don't go at all. As you should understand about devotees, we are eternal associates. Death means the ultimate failure to perpetuate relationships. So if we have made relationships on the bodily platform, then we experience death. But if our relationship is with Krishna, that relationship is not destroyed. And also the relationship with devotees is not destroyed. As Prabhupada said in a letter, we shall have another, there's another ISKCON in the spiritual sky. He said to this devotee, it's not just that you're going back to Godhead, but it's also he's going and he's going and he's going. He just said, Mr. Nair must stay. Mr. Nair was the person that was cheating him out of the, trying to cheat him out of the property he was buying from him in Bombay. He said, Mr. Nair must stay. the attachment to devotees, I mean, on the basis of not the body and the mind, but on the basis of, in other words, the relationship with the Bodhi is a relationship in which Krishna is in the center. In other words, there's not just two of us, there's three. Any relationship where it's just me and another person and no third, no Krishna, then that's usually that sense gratification of some kind or another. But the relationship where I'm very conscious this person is in relationship to Krishna and I'm in relationship to Krishna, we have a relationship because together we're serving Krishna, we're chanting Hare Krishna, we're doing service, then, yeah, you should have plenty of those relationships. And you can become attached to the devotee on that basis. And maybe for a little while there may be some separation. But, you know, you may miss the person just as they've gone to India, but you'll get back together again. So they go to the spiritual sky. That's just another temple, a nice one, where everything works. You don't have to pay the bills. But, you know, that's the continuity. So that's fine. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.